True Crime Medieval, 1,000 Years of People Behaving Badly. I'm Anne Brannon. I'm your host in Albuquerque.
And I'm Michelle Butler in Tuscaloosa, where it is the coldest it has been since we got here.
Oh, really? How cold is it?
It was 11 degrees when we woke up this morning.
Now, this is 11 degrees Fahrenheit, yes? Mm-hmm. So it's not like 80 degrees below Fahrenheit, which it was in Siberia, where the pipes were freezing.
we had half an inch of snow yesterday when we woke up, and every single thing was closed. The university was closed.
Oh, that's
the
exciting.
Community college was closed. Like, everything was closed because it was also icy as much as anything.
The southern ice storms. Oh, no.
There's no way to go treat the road or anything. You just have to wait for it to warm up and melt.
Did you have heat?
Yes.
And were there eggs?
Were there what?
Eggs. Did you have eggs?
We have eggs in the house, so we're good.
So it wasn't like being in Russia.
Oh, no, we're okay.
Where there is no heat and there is no eggs. Okay.
Nope.
Just asking. We also have heat and eggs in Albuquerque.
And butter.
Oh, even better. I don't know about the butter situation in Russia. I just knew about the eggs and the heat. The pipes are breaking in the horrible cold because they're Soviet pipes and they can't be fixed because the people that would fix them are off in Ukraine, and you can't afford the materials to fix them because that's being spent on some stuff that's going on in Ukraine. So I saw this picture of this cloud of steam. The biggest city in Siberia is like the third biggest in Russia. Cloud of steam because this hot water pipe, which was supposed to be heating everything, broke. And so then what there was ice all over.
Right.
People were annoyed. Yeah, it's still sort of wintry around here. We had some snow the other day, but it's gone now. But it's still there up in the mountains. And today we are talking about, okay, here's the deal. We were going to talk about, Michelle said, let's talk about the Crimean slave trade. And I said, okay. And she said, okay. So it turns out that what we would be talking about if we really did that would be the history of the world. And so we didn't want to do that because that's too long for a podcast. So we're really kind of boiling it down, slave trade in the Black Sea. And we're going to start by talking briefly about in the Republic of Florence, some short time before 1428, Maddalena, who was a slave from the Circassian, she had been a slave in the Crimean slave trade and she being bought in Venice, and she was taken to Florence by the guy who bought her, who was the father of the child that she had, who was Carlo di Cosimo de' Medici. So I was happy about finding that because it was hard to find people's names, although Michelle has one that she'll mention later, but then we're going to do an entire podcast about her. So Maddalena is just simply an example of one of the, what has got to be millions of people sold in the Black Sea trade from like the beginning of written history until about 1970.
I really did not know when I put Kaffa on the list. Hey, let's look at this.
Let's talk about Kaffa.
the city that is the center of this. I mean, when I ran across it and it said, this was just me and my Eurocentric learned point of view.
We learn many things here, don't we?
Oh my gosh. When I read, hey, you know, there was this slave market in Kaffa in Crimea, I thought, wow, that's really interesting. But it never once occurred to me it was going to be huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now we know.
Enormous.
I was reading things that talked about how little in the West people do know about this. And so I'm glad to have rectified this, at least in our cases. And whoever's listening to this, hi. Hi, we learned some stuff. We'll tell you. Okay, here we go. You ready? You ready, Michelle?
Yeah.
Okay. So Maddalena had been bought in Venice. She was a Circassian victim of the slave trade coming out of the Caucasus, the Genoese Republic. Had held the slave trade for the Crimean markets to Egypt, but Venice had been taking things over by the 1200s. Well, what's the background to all this? It'll be so brief as I can. Europe had been practicing slavery all of history has slavery written down in it. And so that's how long Europe had been doing it, is the historical period. And in Europe, it would be people captured in war, mostly, or the Vikings were capturing people, raiding, you know, so you would capture people. Serfdom actually replaced that economically. So you didn't need slaves anymore because you had serfs. I have never, Michelle, do you? I have never been able, no one has ever been able to explain to me why it is that we don't call serfs slaves. Do you know this? Because they look, it looks like slavery to me. I don't know why. What? Do you know?
I think that's a really interesting question.
Well, apparently there's some difference because people say they're not the same, but I don't know why.
I am not sure what the, I mean, I'm sure that the people who study this have some kind of reason, but it looks similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it looks similar. Now, the serfs haven't been captured in war. They've just been born into it. Okay, so serfdom replaces it. And criminals could be enslaved also, especially in the Germanic regions, that was legal. But there were some rules about this, though, of course, they weren't always followed. For one thing, the queen of the Franks, Matilda, became regent after Clovis II, who was her husband, died. She was regent for her young son. And she had been enslaved. And as regent, she outlawed enslaving Christians. Okay, so in the Frankish kingdoms, you could not enslave Christians. Of course, there's other people besides Christians, but at least there's some here that you couldn't. But slave trading as a major enterprise, that is not just capturing slaves and keeping them or trading them or whatnot, but slave trading as an economic enterprise was really founded on selling slaves to the Islamic world, and Christians weren't supposed to be sold to non-Christians, although that rule got violated a lot. And so non-Christians were the focus of the trade from the pagan areas of Europe, which, of course, would get smaller and smaller as time went on, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Michelle, you remember this, which is the last place in Europe to become Christian?
Lithuania, I remember.
Lithuania, it is indeed Lithuania. Like it's like in the Middle Ages that it becomes like the 1400s or something like that. So slaves from Eastern Europe, the Balkan slave trade, that's where a lot of the slaves were coming from to go to the Middle East. Doesn't that just make sense? They weren't Christian, they didn't count. And so we refer you actually to our podcast on that Lithuanian prince monk. And also I discussed the Lithuanian grass snakes there too, which are really great. But the Balkans were sort of this buffer between Roman Catholicism and Orthodox Christianity, like to go back and forth, the Roman Catholicism on one side, Orthodox Christianity on the other, and Lithuanian remained pagan. And they were also politically unstable. So there were a lot of war captives, which you could then sell to Vikings. And the Balkan slave trade to Venice ended when the Ottomans took over the Balkans. And so then it was connected to the Crimean slave trade. So that's the point at which that goes into the Crimeans. And the Venetians simply could not compete at that time. And so the Crimean slave trade became the major slave trade of Eurasia. So the Venetians established trading colonies in Crimea. It isn't like they left the slave trade. No, no. They weren't the bosses of it anymore. So they established colonies. And the Circassians, like the Abkhazians and the Mongolians, were sold to the slave traders by their families. That's another way that you could get enslaved. If you were in a poor family, you might get sold. And they could be captured on slave raids because the Caucasians, they sold Christians. And so that's how Maddalena ended up in Florence. She was captured in Circassia. She's just one human in a major flow of slavery and enslaving over centuries. The slave trading in the Black Sea had been going on since Grecian and Roman times and continued until the 20th century. So then why? Why the Black Sea and Crimea? Because it was a locus of trade routes in between Europe and Asia and the Mediterranean. The Silk Road was one of them, for instance. The boundaries of empires were shifting through it. They go back and forth. And religious boundaries shifted back and forth. With a lot of movement and uncertainty and upheaval, there's a lot more opportunity for capturing people and going and getting them and selling them. The Greeks established slave trading colonies on the Black Sea coast, and pagans from Eastern Europe and Northern Europe were sold to Byzantium, where they would be made to become Christians. or they would be sold into the Ottoman Empire, where they would be made to convert to Islam. So you could go either way. The Hungarian Magyars sold the Slavs of Central and Eastern Europe to Kersh on the Black Sea. The Vikings sold the people that they captured as slaves in raids to traders in the Black Sea. Those people were often Christian, but because the Vikings were pagan, they didn't care. And they were replaced, the Vikings were, by pirates from the Baltics and the Rus. Once the Kievan Rus started to disintegrate, they sold captives from their many disagreements. They were having disagreements while the Kievan Rus fell apart. And they would sell it to the Black Sea slave traders, who were really right there, much closer than if you were in, like, I don't know, Sweden or something. It's much closer if you're part of the Rus. The Bulgar Khan captured Russians and sold them to the slave traders because they were infidels, because they were Christians. So, you know, that's all right. But by the middle of the 15th century, Crimea was the center of the slave trade. Most of the income for the Khanate came from slave trading because it was one of the biggest sources of slaves to the Ottoman Empire, along with the Barbary slave traders, which operated out of North Africa. But we're not even going to mention them again because all the other stuff was too big. So there's Barbary slave traders also supplying slaves to the Ottoman Empire, but we're just going to stay in Crimea. The Crimean Khanate, which regarded itself as the successor of the Golden Horde, which was the Mongol Empire sector of the Northeast, which incorporated Siberia, Central Asia, and Eastern Europe, that was established in 1441. So that's the Crimean Khanate. Okay. And at first, the Tatars of the Crimean Khanate just simply taxed the Italians, who were the slave traders, and they conducted slave raids. But, you know, they were mostly, it was just taxation for a while, but they needed more money. So the Crimean Tatars united with the Ottoman Empire, and they conquered all of the Islamic slave trading centers in Crimea. And the Ottomans and the Crimean Khanate then took over the slave trade. Okay, are we following this? I found this, like, so complex.
I appreciate so much you distilling it, because I read a lot about it and just ended up getting more and more overwhelmed.
Yeah, I kept trying to make timelines because I understand things by time, which is weird since I have ADHD and we have time blindness. Maybe that's actually why I'm focused on it anyway. So that's what I was trying to do. But boy, is it difficult. There's so many different boxes just kind of like sliding all around and having fights with each other. Anyway, okay, so we're at the point where the Ottoman Empire has conquered Crimea, and they have all the slave trading slaves. Fair enough. So the Crimean Tatars also allied with the Nogai Horde, which was really big on slave raids, really, really big on slave raids. Twice a year in the fall and in the winter, the Nogai Horde raided the Caucasus and Russia and Poland, Lithuania, which is now Poland, Lithuania, and Ukraine, and they took people to Kaffa. Now, that's what you would have been seeing.
Yeah, that was the thing I ran across in the beginning where I was like, aha, let's look at this. That sounds crimey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's what they were doing. That's what they did. That's where they got most of their money, is they raided this area, which includes the steppes. The major slave port in Crimea was Kaffa, which is now Theodosia, which is like from its original Greek name, which was Theodosia. It was a Greek trading colony originally. Okay, so this is Kaffa, and it went on for 3 centuries. Okay. The estimates are based on fragmentary evidence, but it looks like there were like 1 million people enslaved from Poland, Lithuania, and the wild fields. The wild fields are eastern and southern Ukraine and western Russia. In large part, it's the steppes, which is flatland. And the societies there were easily raided for a couple of reasons. Many of them were nomadic, even when they were in the cities, they moved around. And so they didn't have a set place of power, and power was decentralized, and they were kind of fractious and fought with each other. And there were sedentary societies made up of farmers, but they weren't, at least at this time, they weren't armed. It was really, really easy to attack farmers. Michelle, you come from a farming community. You come from a farming community on flat land. Can you imagine how this would be true?
Yeah, right by a river too. I mean, you could take your boat right up the Mississippi, grab a few people, and be gone.
Yeah, there you go.
Which is essentially what the Vikings did and these other raiders.
If you were the no-guy horde, you could just like kind of ride your horses across all that flatland.
Yeah, I think that's why one of the reasons this works so well on the Black Sea is that you can get your captives to a boat relatively quickly and get them away very fast, and their relatives don't have any kind of ability to trace you.
So it was easy raiding. It was flatland and a population without much organization or defense. The population of Crimea was 75% enslaved people, and the second language in Crimea was Polish from the number of Polish captives that had been taken there. And those were the slaves that made it, because many more people than this would have died in the raids or died on the way there. They weren't lucky enough to be on boats. They were being quick marched to try and get them to where they needed to be sold quickly. If you were weak or elderly or infirm, you couldn't make it, they killed you. 80% of the slaves in Crimea were women, because they were the most valuable. Their price was twice that of the men. After 1502, the Golden Horde, from which you remember the Crimean Tatars had broken off and over in 1441, the Golden Horde was over by 1502. And at that point, there's then no buffer in between the Crimean Khanate and Lithuania and Moscow. So the Crimean Khanate just did a lot of moving on out. They went back and forth with alliances as it was useful and as they wanted. For instance, they were allied with Russia from 1500 to 1506, while Russia was at war with Lithuania. But then in 1507, they started raiding Moscow. Because, you know, they weren't really a people that you would make like long agreements with. In 1571, the Crimean Khan burnt down Moscow and enslaved 150,000 people. Ivan the Terrible, by the way, got out because he ran away from Moscow when they were coming, so he was okay. Being enslaved by the Crimean Khanate was a very bad thing. The men were mutilated and branded and forced to work in irons. The women were sold as maids, or if they were young, as sex slaves. They were given bad food, bad water, little shelter. And as I say, on the way there, they were not treated well either, and many of them died just from that. And the reason they're being quick marched is that the slave traders want to get them, the raiders want to get them away from where the rescuers might be able to help. So if you were too weak, you just got killed. In 1572, the Russians actually won two battles with the Crimean Khanate. That's it, I'm moving on. There were various kinds of slave traders besides the Crimean Khanate. The Russian slave traders captured Finns and trafficked them to the Black Sea slave trades. They did that on into the 1600s. This included Swedes in the Great Northern War, which was 1700 to 1721. And the Swedish ambassador to Constantinople, you know, they were sold to Constantinople. The Swedish ambassador got there and he was able to buy a whole lot of them back, but he didn't have enough funds to get everybody. And so some of them were left there. In 1769, during the Russo-Turkish War, the last slave raid was held, but all the Russian captives were released from Crimea in 1773. And in 1774, all the slaves on Crimea were released, but it took a long time to get everybody home, so thousands were still there the next year. And Crimea got annexed by Russia in 1783, and the Crimean Khanate was dissolved. However, although the Crimean slave trade was abolished, the Circassians were still enslaved and traded to the Ottoman Empire. The slave trade simply kind of redirected after the Crimean part was shut down. And it was mostly women. And that trade went on until the early 20th century. But it didn't disappear. And in the 1960s and 1970s, Saudi Arabia, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates banned slavery.
Wow. I did not know that was that late. Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one thing also for us, like as being Americans, I mean, we are very, very clear on slavery, but we think of it from, you know, as Americans, as this thing that was going on in America, which is a really different time frame and a different route, a different set of economic circumstances. So it's different people. So it isn't this at all. If indeed people who are enslaved in America have been being brought in from the Black Sea, we would know about it. But we don't, do we? Because we're Americans. And so we're not only Eurocentric, we're like really American centric. And so there's so much we don't know. But now we know that. We know that. There was a whole lot of slave trading going on throughout Europe in the Middle Ages, from the beginning of history on and for a long time. And it got outlawed in various ways. Different pieces of it got outlawed at certain times, and that the laws, you know, weren't always followed. And there was slave raiding back and forth, and things changed whenever government changed, which was fairly often, really, across Europe. Kept on going. And the Crimean Tatars are from the Crimean Khanate are no longer, they haven't been doing slave trading for quite some time. And in Ukraine, they are the indigenous people of Ukraine. And the Russians have exiled them from Crimea a couple of times. And their hope is that when the war of Russia's invasion of Ukraine is over, they will get to go back home, because Crimea is Ukraine. As long as Crimea is held by Russia, they can't go home.
This was a big, big topic. I thought that we were getting a hold of something regional here, not something. It's been a good learning experience of, just because I haven't heard of it doesn't mean it isn't a big thing. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, this entire 4 years has been like a little journey of discovery in a lot of the time. But I think this was the biggest of the discoveries. Ah, look at this. Things that I'm glad I know now. Okay, so you told me, Michelle, that you have a couple of different lists.
I have a list of things that I learned that shocked me, which shouldn't be too surprising, since I just learned about an entire enormous slave-based economy in Eastern Europe and Asia, basically forever, that I had somehow missed. And that's the first thing that I learned that shocked me, the scope and longevity of the Black Sea slave trade. Really, I should have figured out. It always has perplexed me, because you'll get told the origin of the word slave in English is from the Slavs, but then there's no explanation of why. Why is that? That's interesting. That's weird. Okay. The number, just the sheer numbers of people who were sold, stolen, or otherwise ended up enslaved, and how many centuries it went on, is just enormous. We'll talk about this, I think, in a later episode, but also the degrees of enslavement are different when you're dealing with the Ottomans and this part of things. So I'll be interested in talking about that when we do the later episode. The involvement of the Genoese and the Venetians was pretty shocking.
You know, we were already, I mean, it's the Venetians who are behind the, like, the worst crime of the Western European Middle Ages is the sack of Constantinople, and the Venetians are behind that. Well, you know, see, you follow the money.
The Genoese just had taken over Kaffa and were like, okay, this is our base now. Their fortress is still there. Should we ever get to go tourist in Crimea again? Should peace ever return?
May that happen, yes.
It's there. You can go see it.
Yeah, I want to go to Crimea.
I had known that travel in the Middle Ages was dangerous. I had known that. I hadn't known that one of the cost-benefit analyses of taking a ship versus riding over land is that every once in a while, if you hire a Venetian to take you somewhere, they take your money and then sell you into slavery anyway. There are instances of this. There are instances that we know of because those people ended up escaping and coming back to file a complaint. Who knows how many times it happened where the enslavement was entirely successful. Good gracious sakes. That's kind of lousy. Take people's money and then be like, you know what? We can increase the profit on this voyage.
There's something kind of deeply psychopathic about it, actually.
We were talking earlier that back when I was an undergraduate, what I was taught about medieval slavery is that in the early Middle Ages, so 500 to 11 or to 500 to the year 1000 roughly, there's a lot of slavery, capturing people in battle, that sort of thing. And that after that, the church kind of, the light bulb comes on and says, gosh, we really should not be doing that. Well, that's not entirely true. What really happens is that there's this, the co-religionist test happens. They just, across the board, Christians, Muslims, all of them decide that the boundary is you don't enslave your co-religionist, but everybody else is fair game.
And then you can make them convert later.
Well, but then you're still allowed to enslave them.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're still slaves. Yeah. You don't like set them free. No.
You can. I actually found this kind of interesting. As an American, we get taught things like, you know, when George Washington died, he freed his slaves in his will. And we're like, what the heck? Why didn't you do that in your lifetime? It was interesting to me to find out that was actually kind of a thing. That if you were feeling a little bad about it in Europe, then you might grant manumission in your will.
So, okay. So it's like it's kind of like a deathbed repentance thing.
Mm-hmm. But it's not something that, you know, American slavers came up with on their own. That was like the grand tradition of, if you want to be able to both benefit and then get the spiritual benefit, here's how you do it.
That's pretty tacky, actually.
Oh, Lordy. I was so shocked about this, not knowing about this. This was the largest slave trade route in the Middle Ages. And it continues. I mean, even after they extend. So really, African slavery, this is what I didn't know. African slavery is an expansion of what was already happening in Europe.
And it happened because Europe becomes more and more problematic the more it becomes a place where there's an idea of you being European.
The enslavers just expand their operations down into Africa, where at that point, more vulnerable people, because you still have the smaller political units that you can set against each other. Other things that I learned that I'm less shocked by, but I'm glad that I learned. There is a lot of scholarship now about the history of slavery and also in global slavery, particularly in the last 15 years.
That was really lovely to see. There's a lot of work on this now.
One of the things that I'm deeply happy to find is that if you look at scholarship from after about 2010, nobody is going to use the term white slavery anymore. Thank God, right? Like that's everything about that term is super problematic. I understand what they're trying to do, but it's not okay, right? Because if you put the qualifier of white slavery onto it, it implies that slavery is, when it's standing alone, enslaving Black people. Not cool. That's not the normal. It normalizes in disturbing ways the idea of enslaving Black people. The term white slavery is so problematic because it, for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that it tends to show up in scholarship, particularly older scholarship, connected with outrage. Like, how dare the Muslim, like there's really kind of hyperbolic older work about, oh my God, how dare the Muslims enslave all these white Christians? Like, who do they think they are? Don't they know it's supposed to work the other way around? I mean, there's this like quivering outrage that I'm happy to report does not show up in scholarship from the last 15 years. We've moved away from pretending or from the implicit assumption that enslaving Black people, well, you know, that was of its time. White people, that was always an outrage. For heaven's sakes.
No, it was of its time, too. It was like a really, 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 really big piece of things. It was normal. There's that St. Patrick getting all enslaved. St. Patrick, you know, and that's just going across the sea. That's not, they didn't even have to, like, go down and sell them in the Black Sea. They just, like, took them over across the Irish Sea, and then there
you could seriously pull together enough stories, biographies of people who had been enslaved in the Middle Ages who ended up being famous to have an actual book.
Mm-hmm. You could, couldn't you?
One scholar who is particularly well known and who I find particularly helpful in this area is Hannah Barker. And one of the things, I read a book of hers. It's very good. Let me go over and make sure to tell you the exact title of it. It's called That Most Precious Merchandise, The Mediterranean Trade in Black Sea Slaves, 1260 to 1500. And she also has a website that is really useful that other people contribute to. It's called medievalslavery.org.
Oh, great. So you'll give us the link in the show notes?
Yeah. One of the things that's really helpful on that website is the link to primary sources. Ooh. So it's specifically a teaching website. It's for mm-hmm. people who want to teach, but there are primary sources. So there are bills of sale, for example, from people who got sold as children by their families.
Mm-hmm. Like from where? Do you remember like places?
Well, the specific ones I'm looking at right now are in the first one was in the register. Well, all three of these actually are registers. Let me just read this. The following three contracts come from the register of a notary named Benedito Bianco, priest of the parish of Saint Euphemia in Venice. So as a notary, Bianco's job was to draw up legal documents and contracts in the correct form. So then these come from his, these are his copies.
So these are people being sold to people in Venice.
Yep. Or at least the contracts being drawn up in Venice. So in one example, they, widow is selling her 15-year-old daughter, probably because they're in really serious trouble, the husband having died.
And I guess I'm trying to think this through. You could be in very difficult circumstances and need money very badly, and so that would be a reason to sell a child. But I think that you could also say to yourself, this will be better for my child than starving.
Yes. Yeah, it's, I mean, it, no good choices. I mean, being a widow in the 14th century is rough stuff. I didn't expect to be bringing up Christine de Pizan, but we know slightly later, Christine de Pizan writes about how much trouble she was in the late 14th, early 15th century when her husband died young and she was left raising three little kids on her own.
And taking care of her mother too.
And people kept showing up and claiming that her late husband had owed them money. And they were in some trouble.
Right. And she didn't have to sell her kids because she started writing. She became a court writer.
She started out first copying contracts and copying documents and then ultimately ended up being the first woman that we know of who made her living as a writer, which is pretty cool. But her description of their situation when her husband died is not in any way nostalgic. She lets you know that they were really in danger. And she has kind of scathing words for the sort of people who would show up to try to take advantage of a recently bereaved young woman with three kids. I did not find fiction or anything about this, but I think it's because I just don't know the right search terms yet. I think there must be fiction that touches on this. I just didn't find the right search terms.
Well, it seems to me that certainly Sir Walter Scott must have written something. You know, it's right up his alley, isn't it?
I did find that there are proverbs still in existence in Ukrainian, in Polish, in Kazakh.
There's Ukrainian folk songs.
Yes, that remember and reference people being kidnapped into slavery. And there are narratives from escaped slaves. And this is also Hannah Barker. She has an article about this. This one's kind of nice because it's in an open source Palgrave Handbook of Global Slavery Throughout History. And she wrote the Slavery in the Black Region chapter. And one of the things she has in there is a description of two men who were captured and then later escaped and were able to write about their capture and their enslavement and then their escape. One of them was an Armenian monk who was captured by the Mongols when they invaded Armenia in 1236. His story is pretty interesting because he actually has to escape. The people try to ransom him and the Mongols say, no, he's too useful. He can read and write. We need to keep him for his skills. And the second, this is fascinating. The second is Johann Schiltberger, who was a barbarian soldier who was captured by Sigismund of Hungary's crusading army in 1396. And he was a military slave for 20 years. And then he wrote about it.
Men were often captured to be sold as soldiers.
You can go and find his writings about his enslavement. which is pretty fascinating. He wrote a book called The Bondage and Travels of Johann Schiltzberger, a Native of Bavaria, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
That was pretty wild. This was quite the topic. And of course, the jewel that I found last night that I was like, but I think she deserves her own podcast is Roxolana.
Yes, Roxolana. Yes.
So this is just a little teaser for Roxolana, who was kidnapped in about 1516 from Ukraine and ends up with the Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. And it's wild. It is a wild story. So we're going to deal with her separately, I think.
She goes on to great heights.
Holy smokes. I'm so impressed. But I want to do some more reading on her because it's the story where like I want to double check every single piece of this because it's so improbable that I want to do some fact checking. Oh goodness.
It does seem improbable, but
I think it really happened, but
it's really happened, but whether all the details are true is unclear.
Yeah, so I need to poke at it some more, but I actually was quite shocked to find how many individuals we know for sure were victims of this widespread.
As for instance, yeah?
Well, as, you know, Johann Schiltzberg or Roxolana or the Crimean monk, there's little children. This stinks. If you were captured as a child, you couldn't petition for your freedom until you turned 14.
Huh.
Now, wild? You can't go to law until you're at least 14. But we talked before about Olaf Tryggvason. He's right part of this. You know, he gets captured, he gets sold. And we talked at that time about how his revenge wasn't about the enslavement. It was about the foster father having been killed by the enslaver.
He was in Russia, so he'd been taken on into Moscow.
And he ended up in Kyiv for a while. He wasn't captured in the Black Sea, but it's part of this early medieval and, alas, late medieval slave trade that I had no idea was this extensive.
And Cervantes.
Oh, yes. Cervantes was captured. So we'll put him on the list, too, because he was captured by Barbary pirates and ended up spending several years as a slave. That'll be fascinating. I didn't know that.
And John Smith.
Oh, yes.
He got captured in war and he was sold into slavery in the Crimean, a slave trade, and ended up, I think, in Constantinople, but he escaped and he became this guy that went to the American, to what would become America. There's some speculation that the Pocahontas story he created out of the story of, what is the name of the woman you were talking about?
Roxolana.
That it kind of grows out of what he knows of the Roxolana story.
I was really surprised because this is what to have this many people named, because this is one of the things about American slavery is that it's really quite difficult to find records with specific people's names. So I really wasn't expecting to find individually named people who had been victims of this. Yeah, I was pretty surprised about the big famine at the beginning of the 14th century that I did not know about, but this is as big of a surprise.
Before the Black Death, but we knew all about the Black Death.
Yeah. Kaffa, where the big slave port was here, is one of the places where the Black Death springboards from.
Oh, I didn't know that. And that's probably from the slave trade, isn't it?
It's because the Genoese are holding it and they're being besieged. And
oh, right.
The people besieging them on the outside are throwing diseased corpses over. And the Genoese are like, it's time to evacuate. So they get in their ships and leave and they take the Black Death and spread it all over the Mediterranean. Thanks, guys. Good job.
I hate the Genoese.
This was such a huge topic. I should have known it was going to be, but I didn't. I did not know.
No, you said, let's do this. And I didn't know either. I just thought, oh, okay. Sounds good. I'd like to learn about Crimea.
Gracious sakes. And then it makes me wonder, you know, I think back to the children going missing in Hamelin.
Right. Yeah. I think that was one of the theories, wasn't it? And it makes sense.
Yeah. That they might have gotten lured out just abducted.
Puts it in a different context that makes a whole lot of sense. So that is our brief, condensed explanation of the slave trade from Crimea in the Middle Ages, the Black Sea slave trade. And we'll give you lots of links to go look for more.
Yes, there are many, many books, many recent books. 2019. Yeah.
The next time you hear from us, we are actually going to be, instead of being like all over the place for hundreds of years, we're going to be in one place for a short time. Except, of course, I'll do context, which usually goes on forever. But the crime itself, one crime, we know where it is. And that is that in 1271 in Italy, Henry de Alman was murdered by the sons of Simon de Montfort. So Frenchmen go to Italy and misbehave. And so, yeah, so we'll talk about that. And this has been True Crime Medieval, where the crimes are just like they are today, only with less technology. We can be found on Spotify and Apple Podcast and any place where the podcasts are hanging out. And you can find us at truecrimemedieval.com. True Crime Medieval is all one word. And there you can find links to the podcast and show notes and transcripts. We get them in as soon as we can. They're not usually on the most recent episodes, but we get them in when we can. And you can also reach us through there and leave comments. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have some crimes from the Middle Ages that you think we should pay attention to, we'd love to hear about them. And we will fit them in as we can. And please, we ask you with all our hearts, let them be like, you know, one crime in one place at one time, rather than millions of crimes over hundreds of years, because that turns out to be that. That's harder, really, to talk about as it happens. Bye.
Bye.